like it.
Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. Once again, you're listening to a speaker from who's sitting in a location in Orlando, in Orange County, Florida. Back where I used to live, there was a, I guess because of the rains, they're so not, I guess, I don't know what it is. I guess it's been so long since they had a heavy rain in Anaheim, California, so a building collapsed near where I used to live. I'm trying to track down the exact address of the building, but it was an adult education center, so it's probably a building I went by many times wondering if I should go in and try to teach English there. But and it wasn't snow that did it. I guess it was rain, because it doesn't snow in Anaheim. It snows up in the mountains. You get to see the snow, but you don't actually experience it there. So anyway, I'll try to track down where that building was. Some of you are listening in California, and some of you may be listening in Minnesota. We got some communication this week from somebody in Minnesota. So we hope that you're doing okay up there. I know it's very cold up there. But then people up there can deal with it. It's warm where I'm talking, where I'm speaking from. This is the 23rd day of the ninth month on the sacred calendar. So we're very close to the 25th day, which is Hanukkah. And today is Shabbat, Sabbath, and it's the 23rd. And tomorrow is the 24th. Those of you who have taken advanced mathematics can keep up with that, I guess. And then the night of the 25th begins the festival of Hanukkah, so that will be Sunday night, Sunday evening. This Sunday evening then begins the festival of Hanukkah. Now, I've been asked some questions before I get into my subject today. I've been asked some questions that I want to try to deal with before I get into the main subject for today. It has to do with history. It has to do with our own situation, though, too. Hanukkah, as you know, is a Jewish holiday. Christ observed it as a good Jew would. It's not commanded on the church. It's not one of the lists in Leviticus 23, of course. There's a story about a person who grew up as a Catholic, but he always wanted to convert to Judaism. He had this fascination with it. And when he got old enough, when he got into college age, he began to study Judaism. He studied Judaism for a whole semester so he could convert. Then it came time for him to take an exam, for the rabbi to examine him so he could convert to Judaism. So he felt he was ready. He comes to the rabbi's office. The rabbi sits him down and says, "So you're here for your exam. You want to convert to Judaism?" He says, "Yes." He said, "Well, first, there's the matter of my fee. It's going to cost you $5,000. And the young man said, "What? That's awfully expensive. How about $500? And the rabbi said, "Congratulations, you passed." Anyway, that joke kind of means is a little more poignant right now, because unfortunately in the Jewish community there have been an awful lot of people who were taken advantage of by a con artist to the tune of millions, well, I guess billions of dollars, and it's actually affected certain philanthropic organizations. And so I've been trying to keep up with the story, because it seems like it really is a major financial disaster. Many organizations invested with this fellow, who turned out to be a crook, I guess, and now they're wondering how they're going to recoup their losses and continue their charitable activities. And I've been reading about how they hope to do it in various ways. It really is a sad story. So that's something that we might want to follow and see how that's going. Another event in the Jewish community that's of interest, I think, world in terms of the whole world, are the elections coming up in Israel in February. And it's not that far away. We're almost at the end of December now, late December. February, they'll be choosing a new prime minister in Israel, so that ought to be very interesting to check on that. Today I'm going to be dealing with events in the Jewish community that have an impact, that have a lesson spiritually for the entire church. And I'm calling this talk, "From This Day I Will Bless You." From This Day I Will Bless You. And I'll get into that in just a moment, but first I wanted to make some comments about Hanukkah. Actually, from week to week, we ought to be taking stock of our situation, spiritually speaking. That's why we have the weekly Sabbath. We need to be evaluating how our life's going. And in the spring of the year, we have the Passover in the early spring to help us with that. And then we have Pentecost late spring to help us with that. Then in the autumn of the year, we have the Holy Day season, which again helps us to pause and take stock where we stand spiritually. Because we have, however long we have on this physical earth, but we have a future beyond that, and that's really what's critical, is eternity. But we don't have commanded holy days in the summer or in the winter. However, we do have very important historical events that we can read about in the Bible. And if we're biblically grounded, when these seasons come up, we can remember, oh, yes, you know, in midsummer we have the events surrounding the destruction of the temple. And then in beginning of winter, we have the events surrounding the pollution and rededication of the temple. And those events remind Christians to take stock of their lives and to seasonally rededicate themselves to their calling. In the Jewish community, it goes beyond that because the Jews are, you might say, that's what they've been called traditionally. The Jews are the people of the book. And they're the ones whose history, more than any other people, is recorded in the scriptures, both past, present, and even their future, for that matter. And so these events are not only biblical events, but to them, they're events in their own history. So they commemorate these events as a people. So they have in their community Purim and Hanukkah, and then some of the more devout keep the fast days that are mentioned in Zechariah 8. So for the Jews, these are national holidays. And Christ did set an example to show us that when there are national holidays that are appropriate, we should be good citizens of our nation and join in. And so he observed Hanukkah, and we Americans observe Thanksgiving with our fellow Americans. So this is an issue as to whether a Christian should observe other holidays other than biblical ones, Colombian holidays, Canadian holidays, whatever they may be, Ethiopian holidays, as Christians. Well, if they're appropriate, yes, if they're appropriate. And Christ did celebrate Hanukkah as a Jew. So it's not that the whole church needs to do it. It's not commanded upon the church to do it, but each nation has its particular holidays, and if they're appropriate, church members can participate. Thanksgiving, as I said, in America, and the 4th of July, I would think, in America, and then whatever days are appropriate. You know, up in Canada, during the Feast of Tabernacles, usually they have a Thanksgiving day. Usually Canadian members are keeping the feast anyway at that time, but there are other days. I'm sure July 1st, of course, Canada Day, when it became a separate dominion, independent of Great Britain in 1867, July 1st, and so on. You know, so there are appropriate days to celebrate, and Christ set that example. And so, as I said, some people ask me whether what Christians should do at Hanukkah time, and I tell them, well, what they should do is read the scriptures that are appropriate to the season and try to learn some of the lessons. They don't have to do what Jews do at that time of the year. Now, some of you may wonder what Jews do at that time of the year. Well, there's certain foods that they eat because these foods are oily. Because the temple was rededicated, the candelabra was lit, it was a festival of lights, and so they eat sufganiyot, or donuts, that are made with oil, and then also potato pancakes. Now, obviously, potatoes weren't even known in biblical times, so they're a recent development for most people. They came from the Western Hemisphere, but they do have potato pancakes made with oil. But the main, of course, celebration of Hanukkah is, well, of course, there's liturgical things, too. Since the Jews have services every day, three times a day, their liturgy will change for the festivals, and so Hanukkah has certain liturgical elements that are different. There's certain extra prayers are said, etc. And then also the critical observance, as you know, is the lighting of the Chanukiah, or the Hanukkah candelabra, which is a menorah, but it's a certain type of menorah. In America, we usually call it a menorah, but in Israel, they call it a Chanukiah because it's specifically for that festival. So it has nine branches. There's the shamash, and then which is the servant candle, and then the eight other candles, which are lit, one, two, three, four, finally eight at the end, with the ninth being the shamash. So it goes from two candles to nine by the end of the 8 days. So that's the main, it's called the Festival of Lights by Josephus. When he wrote about the festival, he called it the Festival of Lights, and it's mainly celebrated with the lighting, you know, of the lights. That's just, you know, just a comment on cultural comment for those of you who are interested, and I think most of you knew all this anyway. But as I said, it's not commanded upon the church as a whole. But tomorrow is the day before all that, right? That starts on the 25th. Tomorrow is the 24th, but tomorrow is a special day on the calendar, the 24th day of the ninth month. And I want to talk about that. That's why I call this talk, "From This Day I Will Bless You." I want to talk about the 24th day of the ninth month of the sacred calendar. I'm going to summarize some things that you probably know. Now, if you don't know, Then that's great. I'd love to be able to share the information with you. I'd be very excited to share this information with people who don't know it, because that's always very exciting. But I think for a lot of you, it's review. So let me just start with some review. Prophecy indicates that blessings were withheld from the people of Israel for a period of seven biblical times. A biblical time is a year of 360 days, and seven biblical times, therefore, is 2,520 days. And since in prophecy there's a principle of a day for a year, 2,520 years go by before special blessings come upon the people of Israel. They're withheld that long. As we go through history, they're withheld for 2,520 years. And these blessings involve two elements: the birthright blessing, which goes to the people of Joseph, and the scepter blessing, which goes to the people of Judah. If you go back to 604 B.C., in the winter of 604, the kings of the Middle East, including, I think, Jehoiakim of Judah, become vassals of the Babylonian Empire, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, or the Chaldean Empire of Nebuchadnezzar. So Judah becomes, the king of Judah becomes ruled by a Gentile monarch. And so the Davidic monarchy remains, let's put it another way, the land of Israel is no longer under a Davidic monarch. Now we go 2,520 years, and finally we come to December 9th, 1917, the 24th day of the ninth month, which happened to be a Sunday, just as tomorrow is going to be Sunday, the 24th day of the ninth month. Back in 1917, 91 years ago, tomorrow, it was on a Sunday, December 9th, 1917, the British General Allenby accepted the surrender of the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, in Palestine, in Jerusalem. And so Jerusalem now was surrendered to the British Empire. And so the King of England became the King of Jerusalem. And I believe he was a descendant of David. So that now the throne of David once again is ruling over Jerusalem. And the next day, as I believe, is when the British troops marched into the city. And as I recall the story, Allenby got off his horse and walked through the gate into the city out of respect for the sanctity of Jerusalem. And that was on Hanukkah. So the British took Jerusalem from the Turks on Hanukkah. And when they marched in, a Jewish force marched in with them. There was a Jewish battalion as part of the British army fighting with the British to liberate Jerusalem. So a Jewish contingent did march in on Hanukkah of 1917 and to liberate Jerusalem from the Turks. It's kind of interesting. And so that did fulfill a prophecy, which was specifically for the land of Israel, that for the people in Israel from that point on received a certain blessing. Now, the British Empire had promised a month before that they would make a homeland for Jews in that area. The Balfour Declaration, the Foreign Secretary of the British Empire, the United Kingdom, Lord Balfour, had... I don't know if he became a lord later, but anyway, Arthur James Balfour, I believe, was his name. He gave the Balfour Declaration a letter he wrote, I believe, to Chaim Weizmann at the time, who was a scientist and later the first president of Israel. He wrote him and said, "We British promise we will give the Jews a homeland in Palestine." So when the British took over Palestine, they did it already having made a commitment to the Jews to give them a homeland there. Now later on, they backed away from that, and the Jews in effect had to rebel against the British the same way the Americans did, and separate from them the same way the Americans did. So in 1947, in effect, the British gave the United Nations the problem of Palestine, the Jews and the Arabs fighting in Palestine. The United Nations divided it up into a Jewish state and an Arab state, and that's we've had the problem with this ever since. We've had the state of Israel, and now we have maybe someday a state of Palestine. We'll see. So those are very interesting events. They've had an impact on the whole world. They're going to have an impact on prophecy. And as I said, so the 24th day of the ninth month has quite a bit of significance. But there's a spiritual significance to it as well, which I'm going to get into today. I want to turn first to Matthew, the sixth chapter. Matthew, the sixth chapter. This is a busy time of the year, because a lot of us are working in environments that are more hectic right now. If we're working in stores, this is the busiest time of the year for many of us. Now, it's true that it's maybe less busy than it might have been, but it's still one of the busy times of the year. In fact, fortunately, we're not working today, but today is called Super Saturday. It's where a lot of people do a lot of shopping. So this is, for many of us, it's a very busy time of the year if we're part of this economy, because this economy really gets into high gear in late December, let's face it. And some of us are being educated, and so we're facing the end of the term and final exams and so on, and so it's busy from that point of view. A lot of the things wrap up at the end of December, final exams, as I said, and then you get ready for the next semester. So there's a lot of things going on. It's very hectic. And what can happen when it gets hectic like that is that you begin to neglect the spiritual side. You get so wrapped up in whatever demands, you know, are being made upon your time, then you neglect your relationship with God, which is an extremely dangerous thing to do. So you have to remember, we have to remember that even at a busy time, you know, God should come first. We should try to fit everything else in, but not neglect the spiritual. And when we make decisions, involving job, involving a location, where are we going to live? Where are we going to work? Who are we going to hang out with? Where are we going to go to school? What, you know, and all these kinds of issues. We need to take spiritual factors into account. We shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't just be aiming for utter efficiency. You know, what's the most effective economic way to do things? We should also think, well, what impact is this going to have on the family? You know, and what impact is this going to have on our time and other things? We need to take everything into account, not just everything. Utter efficiency is the answer to everything. No, we want to take, you know, into account the spiritual. So I remind everyone to remember Matthew 6 and verse 33, where Christ warns about being overly concerned with the physical to the point of, you know, getting obsessed with it and leaving the spiritual aside. And he says, rather, in Matthew 6:33, Christ says, but seek first, Matthew 6:33, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Now, if you go back to ancient times, the Jews were in exile. They were allowed by Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, to go back to their land. But he told them, go back and rebuild your temple. He gave them permission to do it. So when they went back there, at first they were rather zealous about their responsibility spiritually. So if you go back to the book of Ezra, this is talking about the time after the fall of Babylon. So we're dealing with about 538 B.C., where the Jews are coming back from exile into their land. And I'm going to get to the book of Ezra. And I think you'll find that early as they entered the land, in the autumn of the, let's go to Ezra 3. They're gathered back in the land now. In Ezra 3, and when the seventh month had come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. Now, if you remember my talk from a week ago, they were under the leadership of Zerubbabel, a descendant of David, but he wasn't a king. He was merely a governor. And also Joshua, or Jeshua, the high priest. Those were the two leaders. And you may remember, too, that there were prophets around at the time, Haggai and Zechariah. So we're in the seventh month, and then it says, then Jeshua, verse 2, the son of Josedech, and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So they did begin off the sacrificial system rather early. And evidently it wasn't long before at least they started building the temple. However, they had neighbors who were hostile to them. That's kind of interesting, isn't it, that Israelis would have hostile neighbors, but that's the way it was back then. Anyway, if you go to Ezra 4, now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of the eternal God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel. So the first thing they tried to do was kind of corrupt the religion of the Jews by mixing into it, blending it in with their religion. You know, let's all get together and kind of have one universal religion. Well, you know, the Jews needed to defend God's religion as it was, you know, as it is, and not blur it, as it were, mess it up. They came to Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers' houses and said to them, let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we have sacrificed him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here, back around 680 B.C. But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel said to them, you may do nothing with us to build a house for our God, but we alone will build to the eternal God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us. You know, if you want to become part of our religion, you know, you know, come on in. You know, you can be circumcised, or if you're already circumcised, you can accept upon yourself the responsibility of the Torah, you know, and join us. But we're not going to have a joint venture, you know, sort of an ecumenical venture of this sort. This is a specifically, you know, a temple for the God who gave us the Torah. You know, it has a specific purpose. We're not going to mix it up, mess it up. So since that didn't work, then the people got angry about it, you know, and since if you're not going to let us mix in with you, we'll stop you. We'll prevent you, hinder you from doing what you want to do. Then the people of the land tried to discourage the people of Judah. They troubled them in building. and hired counselors against them. So, you know, history is the way it is. They hired the lawyers to go to the government and shut them down, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Darius took over in 522. So all that time, for about 536 to about 522, 14 years, you know, they kept them from building that temple. But after a while, you know, the legal battle was over, and time had gone on, and new kings had arisen, and the Jews could have tried again. That's the problem. The problem is that once they were discouraged from building, they didn't pursue the matter anymore. They just let it ride. And that was a mistake on their part, because it was very important to have that sanctuary built, to have an institution up and running. And God intended that they rebuild that temple. Cyrus had even sent them back there to rebuild that temple. God had inspired him to do that. And yet they were letting it just go. They weren't dealing with it. They'd sort of gone on to their own concerns and let it alone. So now I want to go to verse 24 of Ezra 5. Because this part, there's an insert that I'm going to skip for now. In verse 24, "Thus the work of the house of God which is at Jerusalem ceased, and it was discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia." So we go about 16 years, and because they were thwarted, they just gave up on it. And that was wrong on their part. With a new king, they should have tried again. They should have said, oh, there's a new administration. Let's see if maybe they'll let us build. But they just let it alone. But finally, you know, they were inspired to go ahead and rebuild. And in other words, they got their priorities back the way they should be. You know, instead of just worrying about, you know, their own homes, their own land, their own jobs, and so on, they also realized we're God's people. And we're here, to, you know, we came back to rebuild the temple, and it's not rebuilt. We haven't done the spiritual work yet. You know, and you know what they found? That when they got their priorities straight, they physically did better. They were not really being very successful. They were in effect running around in circles. They were working very hard and not really accomplishing much. And the reason was because God was not blessing them, because he wanted them to have the temple rebuilt. Get the spiritual side straight, and then I'll bless you, not before. Then for chapter 5, "Then the prophet Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophets, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them." Now, this is being written for people who are not that well informed about the Bible. This is written in Aramaic for general readers, so it's worded a little differently until you get to the Passover portion. You know, this portion is written in Aramaic, so it's for more of a general audience. Verse 2, "So Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, rose up and began to build the house of God which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them." Well, again, the governor at that time, he needed to make sure what's going on. Hey, what's going on here? The Jews are getting involved in this project. Is this all right? You know, I won't say, is this kosher? You know, but is this all right? I better check back with the imperial government to make sure, you know. Check back with the empire. The empire might strike back, you know. Anyway, chapter 3. "At the same time, Tattenai, the governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai and their companions came to them and spoke thus to them, 'Who has commanded you to build this temple and finish this wall?'" Well, of course, that had been their original opportunity. That had been the original command of Cyrus. "Then accordingly we told them the names of the men who were constructing this building. But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, so that they could not make them cease till a report could go to Darius. Then a written answer was returned concerning this matter." So they were initially concerned, hey, maybe this isn't the right thing. Because after all, it had been stopped before. "This is a copy of the letter that Tattenai sent. The governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai and his companions, the Persians who were in the region beyond the river, to Darius the king. They sent a letter to him in which it was written thus, 'To Darius the king, all peace. Let it be known to the king that we went into the province of Judea to the temple of the great God, which is being built with heavy stones, and timber is being laid in the walls. And this work goes on diligently and prospers in their hands.'" So they noticed they were making good progress. "Then we asked those elders and spoke thus to them, 'Who commanded you to build this temple, to finish these walls?' We also asked them their names to inform you, that we might write the names of the men who were chief among them." This is verse 11 now. And thus they returned us an answer, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and completed. Of course, Solomon. But because our fathers provoked the God of heaven to wrath, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the Chaldean, which I commented on earlier, who destroyed this temple and carried the people away to Babylon. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to build this house of God. Also, the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple that was in Jerusalem and carried into the temple of Babylon, those King Cyrus took from the temple of Babylon, and they were given to one named Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. Now, this Sheshbazzar may be another name for Zerubbabel. The way they're wording it here, you wouldn't think so, but it's possible. And he said to them, take these articles, go, carry them to the temple site that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be rebuilt on its former site. I'm now in verse 16 of chapter 5 of Ezra. Then the same Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and that perhaps was done on the 24th day of the ninth month. Remember, in the seventh month, they had offered sacrifices on an altar. You can offer sacrifices without building a complete temple. You can go to the spot, you know, the Temple Mount, that rock there, where there now sits a Muslim shrine, the Dome of the Rock. But you can go to that rock. I've been inside of there, and I've seen that rock. I mean, Orthodox Jews aren't supposed to go, but I was a church member when I went, so in spite of the warnings, I walked in. You know, there's a rock there, and Orthodox Jews, as I said, aren't supposed to go there because they're ritually impure, but I went. My ancestors used to slaughter animals there, so I decided I'd go. But anyway, there's this rock there, and you can build an altar there and offer sacrifices, even though there isn't a temple structure. But they evidently, later on that year, went ahead and began building a temple. But then they were stopped, as you know. So I'm now back in verse 16. Then the same Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. But from that time, even until now, it has been under construction. It is not finished. Well, why? It's because they stopped them. They wouldn't let him finish it. Now they're starting again. Now, therefore, if it seems good to the king, let a search be made in the king's treasure house, which is there in Babylon, whether it is so that a decree was issued by King Cyrus to build the house of God at Jerusalem, and let the king send us his pleasure concerning this matter. So the king, you know, took due diligence with it, and he checked. He wanted to honor the earlier rulers had done. Then King Darius issued a decree. This is chapter 6. And a search was made in the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon, in Akmathah, in the palace that is in the province of Media, and at Akmathah, in the palace that is in the province of Media, a scroll was found, and in it a record was written thus. And this is in Aramaic so that, you know, Gentiles of that day could understand it. In the first year of King Cyrus issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. And of course, the end of Second Chronicles has this material if you want to look it up there. Let the house be rebuilt, the place where they offered sacrifices, and let the foundations of it be firmly laid, its height 60 cubits and its width 60 cubits, with three rows of heavy stones and one row of new timber. Let the expenses be paid from the king's treasury. So the government, the imperial government, was going to subsidize this. And also let the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple, which is in Jerusalem, and brought to Babylon, be restored and taken back to the temple, which is in Jerusalem, each to its place, and deposit them in the house of God. So that was certainly a very positive gesture of Cyrus. To the material that had been pillaged, he was going to, turn back. Now, therefore, Tatnai, governor of the region, beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai, and your companions, the Persians who are beyond the river, beyond the Euphrates, keep yourselves far from there. You know, just leave them alone. Don't bother them. You know, they have authorization to do this. Let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God on its site. Moreover, I issue a decree as to what you shall do for the elders of those Jews. This is King Darius talking. For the building of this house of God, let the cost be paid at the king's expense from taxes on the region beyond the river that is to be given immediately to these men so that they are not hindered. I'm sorry, this is to be given immediately to these men so that they are not hindered. So the government will subsidize it as it originally committed itself to do. It's going to keep its commitments. And whatever they need, young bulls, rams, and lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, and oil, according to the request of the priests who are in Jerusalem, let it be given them day by day without fail. that they may offer sacrifices of sweet aroma to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. So the king wanted the God of the Jews to be prayed to for the sake of the empire. And I issue a decree that whoever alters this edict, notice what's going to happen if you try to stop it. Let a timber be pulled from his house and erected, and let him be hanged on it. I think that would discourage you from interrupting the work. And let his house be made a refuse heap because of this. So the king said, this is going to go forward. On pain of death, it's going to go forward. And may the God who causes his name to dwell there destroy any king or people who put their hand to alter it or to destroy the house of God which is in Jerusalem. I, Darius, issue a decree. Let it be done diligently. Then Tatnai, the governor of the region beyond the river, Shethar-Boznai, and their companions diligently did according to what Darius had sent. So they followed through on it. They did their part. And so I'm in verse 14 of verse 6. We're still reading in Aramaic here. So the elders of the Jews built, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo. And they built and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel, and according to the command of Cyrus, Darius, and he also mentions in Artaxerxes, king of Persia. So this is now updating it way beyond the time I'm talking about, because the book of Ezra was written much later. So they're even pushing events even into the 450s B.C., which is beyond the general time I'm talking about. And now let's go back to the time I'm talking about, verse 15. So now the temple was finished in the third day of the month of Adar, which is in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. So that should be in 516 B.C. I believe it was in March of that year, the third day of the month of Adar, you know, the last month of the sacred year. And it was in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. And so at that point, they keep the Passover. Where they keep the Passover, it switches to Hebrew. That's in the 19th verse. It switches back to Hebrew because they're talking there about the Passover. Okay, so everybody follow what's going on. So the Jews wanted to rebuild the temple. They were discouraged from doing so. And then after a while, they just gave up on it. And then finally, the prophet stirred them up to do it. And this time, the authorities were not happy about it, but they checked into it. Turns out it was something that needed to be done. So then they supported it. It was done. Things worked out really well. And so after 70 Passovers were missed, 587 B.C., the temple was destroyed. And so from that point on, there were no Passovers kept until the Passover here that's covered in Ezra 6. So there were 70 Passovers that were missed, where there was no lamb to be offered. No temple was standing. Well, there might have been lambs offered. I take that back. There might have been lambs offered on the altar. But let's say this is the first Passover where there was a temple in which to offer the lamb. There were 70 years with no temple, 70 Passovers without a temple. Okay, are you with me? So now let's focus on what the prophets did to get the Jews stirred up to build, because this gives you the general story. But I want to go now to the book of Haggai and focus in more on the attitude the Jews had and how they had to be stirred up to get back to build the temple in 522, 14 years after they had been stopped. So now let's go to the book of Haggai. Now, obviously, if a man is named Haggai, that connects with the word for Chag, festival. So Haggai could be translated festal, F-E-S-T-A-L. Maybe he was born on a festival. So anyway, Haggai, in the second year of King Darius, in the sixth month, on the first day of the month. So now this is the sixth month on the sacred calendar, which is Elul. And so it's a month before the seventh month, which is the festival month. And Elul is when Jews begin to reevaluate themselves. As I said, you know, in the autumn of the year, in the spring of the year, God has programmed us to take stock of ourselves because we have festivals coming up. What I'm saying is that also in the other two seasons, we should do likewise. In this time of year, the winter's about to come. When's the first day of winter? It's Monday, right? I think the first day of Hanukkah is also the first day of winter. So with a new season, we need to take stock and rededicate ourselves to God. And Hanukkah is certainly a good time for that, Feast of Dedication. So here it is in the sixth month, you know, so that's late summer. On the first day of the month, the word of the Eternal came by Haggai the prophet to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, saying, now there are going to be four messages you'll see here, and the first one is given in the sixth month, on the new moon of the sixth month. Thus speaks the Eternal of hosts, saying, the people says, the time has not come, the time that the Eternal's house should be built. They put it off. It was too much hassle. You know, we don't want to go through that. Somebody's going to try to stop us. Yeah, but you could try. Then the word of the Eternal came by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses and this temple to lie in ruins? So as he said, you know, you're busy worrying about your own situation. What about the spiritual situation? Now, therefore, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, consider your ways. You find this message four times in the book, to put your heart on a matter. Put your heart on it is the Hebrew. Consider is to put your heart on it. Consider your ways. You have sown much and bring in little. You eat but do not have enough. You drink and you are not filled with drink. You clothe yourselves but no one is warm. And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes. You know, you gather wealth, but it doesn't seem to be enough to support you. The economy is in bad shape. Why? Because your values are all askew. You need to get spiritually in shape, and then the economy will follow. By the way, one thing I'm noticing, you know, just as the economic news has become so bad, along with it, we're getting a lot of news about just outright corruption. And corruption eventually does lead to economic trouble. If people are cheating one another, it eventually does lead to an economic collapse. For example, right before the Great Depression of 1929, there was just a lot of corruption going on in the economy. Anyway, in verse 7, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountains and bring wood and build a temple, that I may take pleasure in it and be glorified, says the Eternal. Now, originally, God had not even necessarily told them to build a temple, you know, but they wanted to build one. He said, it's a wonderful idea. If you want to do it, do it. But now that, you know, you've done it, it needs to be rebuilt. It was important in your history, important spiritually for you, and it needs to be rebuilt, and it had not been. You looked for much, but indeed it came to little, and when you brought it home, I blew it away. Why, says the Eternal of Hosts, because of my house that is in ruins, while every one of you runs to his own house. Therefore, the heavens above you withhold the dew, and the earth withhold its fruit. For I call for a drought on the land and the mountains, on the grain and the new wine and the oil, on whatever the ground brings forth, on men and livestock and all the labor of your hands. In other words, I was not blessing you because you were perverse in your values. So that's the first message. That comes on the beginning of the sixth month. So that's roughly August on the sacred calendar. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the temple, obeyed the voice of the Eternal their God, and the words of Haggai, the prophet, as the Eternal their God had sent him, and the Eternal feared the presence of the Eternal. The people feared the presence of the Eternal. That's great. A positive response. So often in the Bible you don't have that. You have people persecuting the prophets, sometimes driving them out, killing them. In this time, they actually responded positively. It's wonderful. Then Haggai, the Eternal's messenger, spoke the Eternal's message to the people, saying, I am with you, says the Eternal. I'm going to bless this effort. And if you remember what I read about in Ezra, the effort was going well. It went well. They got it finished, and they had the Passover, as we read about there. Well, I didn't read about it, but I came up to that point and stopped. You could read about it in Ezra 6. Then Haggai, I read that, verse 14. So the Eternal stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and worked on the house of the Eternal of Hosts, their God, on the 24th day of the sixth month in the second year of King Darius. So the first day of the month was the message. They got organized, and on the 24th day, towards the end of that month, they started working on it. Right before the fall festival season, they got going on that project. Everybody with me until now? All right, so now we come to the fall festival season, and there's another message. And now we're in Haggai 2, and we're in another message. In the seventh month, on the 21st day of the month, all right, use your minds. This is the festival of Hoshana Rabbah. This is the seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles, the day of the great Hosanna. The last day, that great day of the festival, right? The seventh day of the festival, the end of the Festival of Tabernacles. And this is Haggai speaking. So Haggai is speaking on a Chag. Makes sense. In the seventh month, on the 21st of the month, the word of the Eternal came by Haggai, the prophet, saying, speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to the remnant of the people, saying, who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory, and how do you see it now? In comparison with it, is this not in your eyes as nothing? So let's go back to 587. There are some old-timers around. It's been how long? About 60 years or so? And some old timers though would still have been around. Let's say they were 10 years old then, so now they're in their 70s. If they were 20, they're in their 80s. So there are some old timers around who remember that earlier temple, and it was a lot better than this little one that they this more basic one that they've built. But don't be discouraged by that. At least you did it, you know. And what's interesting is that this temple later on was embellished. It didn't stay a modest structure. God said, don't be worried about it. You did the best you could with what you had to do with. Solomon had a mighty empire. Solomon was a very wealthy king. The Jews now were a territory under the Persians. A remnant had come back. Their greatest days were behind them, at least for many centuries. Their greatest days are yet ahead, but for many, many years, their greatest days have been behind them, the days of Solomon. So you can't compare that second temple with Solomon's. But what was interesting is, that Herod comes along towards the end of the first century B.C., and Herod was a great builder and built projects all over the Roman Empire. And Herod embellished that second temple, and for 49 years they built on that second temple. In the time of Christ, they were finishing it up. And it was beautiful, and it was probably better than Solomon's. Herod's temple was just magnificent, and many of us have seen models of it right here in Orlando. You drive by the 4 highway, and you see a model of Herod's temple. Yeah, that's living in the Bible Belt has its advantages, All right, anyway. So let's go hear what he says. He says, "All right, don't be discouraged. I understand this temple is not no great cheese compared to Solomon's. But take heart, you've done the job. Yet now be strong, Zerubbabel, says the Eternal, and be strong, Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and be strong, all you people of the land." So that message is there 3 times, like he told, as he told Joshua, be strong and of good courage, says the Eternal, and work, for I am with you, says the Eternal of hosts. According to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remains among you. Do not fear. That is one of the great themes of the Hanukkah season, too, that, the power of God's spirit. In fact, the Jews read during Hanukkah, Zechariah 4:6. Let's go there, because he was there with Haggai. Let's read the next prophet that you read come to is Zechariah. Zechariah 4:6. You should be here sometime. Those of you who are listening electronically, all kinds of excitement goes on over here during the course of a Sabbath service. It's amazing. Anyway, Zechariah 4:6. So he answered and said to me, this is Zechariah 4:6. This is the word of the Eternal to Zerubbabel. Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Eternal of hosts. How did the Maccabees beat the Hellenists? How did they defeat Antiochus? Because, God intervened for them. It was God's will that army defeat the superior army, which, the Maccabees did. But it was a divine intervention. All right, anyway, let's go back to Haggai. For thus says the Eternal of hosts, this is verse 6, once more, it is a little while, I will shake heaven and earth, the sea and dry land. Now evidently the little while part refers to the fact that very shortly their fortunes would turn around and they would begin to see increased prosperity, increased success. And then ultimately, of course, it would lead to the climax of human history where in the coming of the Messiah. So I think that the little while part refers to the, one commentary brought this out, and I think it could be correct, refers to the fact that very shortly things began to look up for them. But ultimately, of course, God plans to completely refashion the whole earth, and Christ will come, and there will be the messianic period, and that's referred to in verse 7. And I will shake all nations, and they shall come to the desire of all nations, and I will fill this temple with glory, says the Eternal of hosts. So some will come to Christ, of course, in repentance. Others will come in opposition. But the focus of attention will be in Jerusalem. And ultimately, Christ will rule from Jerusalem. And the temple here, symbolically, is a type of the church. The church, of course, will be glorious at that time. And there also will be even a third temple that will be even greater than the second one. But even the second one became a lot better than the one that Haggai saw. Under Herod, it became very impressive, and Christ himself did go in there. So God came to this earth, as Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the first coming of Christ, and he did enter that temple. and that temple of Herod. So greater than the temple of Solomon in a way was that temple of Herod, because Christ literally walked in there. First he came there as a baby, and then he walked in as an adult. Of course, he came as a teenager too, as a young person. Anyway, let's go to verse 7. And I will shake all nations, and they shall come to the desire of all nations, and I will fill this temple with glory, says the Eternal of Hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, says the Eternal of Hosts. So don't worry that you're not that prosperous. You're okay. You wish you had more, but don't worry about it. I've got all the wealth there is. I'll see to it that it all works out. The glory of this latter temple shall be greater than the former. And that's what happened. Herod's temple was much greater than that of Solomon's, and much greater than certainly that of Haggai. And it also refers to the church. And incidentally, there's also going to be a third temple that will come when Christ returns. And we'll talk about that maybe at another time. But there will be a third temple in the millennium. The glory of this latter temple shall be greater than the former, says the Eternal of Hosts. And in this place I will give peace, says the Eternal of Hosts. That's got a double meaning, because Christ came and he was the Prince of Peace. But then ultimately, you know, from that temple mount and from that third temple will come, of course, peace for the whole world, the millennium. On the 24th day of the ninth month, in the second year of Darius, the word of the Eternal came by Haggai the prophet, saying, so we had one message on the new moon of Elul. Then we had another message on the seventh day of the Festival of Tabernacles. Now we have a third message on the 24th day of the ninth month. And the anniversary of that will be tomorrow. And evidently that was the day on which they had originally started building the temple, which had been, of course, interrupted. But that was the day on which they started building it. So when they came to that day again, God said to them, I'm going to use this day as a mark, because it's when you started building, and from this day I'm going to bless you. Verse 11. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, now ask the priest concerning the law, saying, if one carries holy meat in the fold of his garment, and with the edge of edge he touches bread or stew, wine or oil or any food, will it become holy? Then the priest answered and said, no. You don't transfer holiness. If you have a sacred object and it touches something else, it doesn't pass on that holiness to the other object. No. On the other hand, if you're unclean, you can make something else unclean with contact. That's the laws of ritual purity. That's the way they work. If you're unclean, you do not touch something else, or it becomes unclean. And Haggai said, verse 13, if one who is unclean because of a dead body touches any of these, will it be unclean? The things mentioned in the earlier verse. So the priest answered and said, it shall be unclean. So he said, unfortunately, it's in effect easier to corrupt something than to build it up. It's harder to build something up than to tear it down, but nevertheless, that's our responsibility, to uphold standards, you know. Just yesterday, I was talking with a fellow teacher, and she made this comment to me. She said, life is an uphill battle. Well, she's a good point. That's really true. Life is an uphill battle, but when you're a Christian, you have God's help. Then Haggai answered and said, so is this people, and so is this nation before me. They're unclean, and they're affecting others, making them unclean. They're a corrupting influence. And that's wrong. And he wants them to turn things around. And now they are. So that's good. So is this people, and so is this nation before me, says the Eternal, and so is every work of their hands. And what they offer there is unclean. See, once you begin to get corrupt, it affects everything. And even the good things you do are tainted because of corruption. And you get this hypocrisy. You get people that, you know, you might say, as we said, they pray on Sunday and pray with people on Sunday and pray on people the rest of the week. Yeah, that's the saying. They pray with people and then pray on people. You know, that's unfortunately what you get. I'm talking about the world as a whole. Let's hope that we're not that way. Verse 15. And now carefully consider. Once again, we have this consider, and you'll see it again in a moment. And now carefully consider from this day forward, from before stone was laid upon stone in the temple of the Eternal. This was the day when you started building, you know, as I reminded you. Since those days, when one came to a heap of 20 ephahs, there were but 10. When one came to the wine vat to draw out 50 baths from the press, there were but 20. You were not doing well. You were not meeting your expectations. Things weren't going well for you because you were too focused on that. You neglected the spiritual side. You were just all wrapped up in yourselves. I struck you with blight and mildew and hail and all the labors of your hands. Yet you did not turn to me, says the Eternal. So sometimes it takes a lot for people to get the point. It's really sad. But sometimes it does take a lot for people to realize that, you know, what they need to do. But they finally, in this case, had realized. So this is really a positive book and a positive time in the history of the church, in the history of the Jews, you know, because they realized that they'd done wrong and they got back in spiritual shape. So it's very inspiring. Verse 18. Consider now from this day forward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day that the foundation of the temple was laid, consider it. So he makes them a promise at that time. Is the seed still in the barn? As yet the vine and the fig tree, the pomegranate and the olive tree have not yielded fruit, but from this day I will bless you. So he tells them at that time, you know, the time now that they are building the temple, that they are getting to work on it, he says, I'm choosing this day when you started building, and I'm telling you that from this day, the 24th day of the ninth month, from this day I will bless you. So they had a relatively prosperous period for a while. Things went well for them for a time. Their temple was rebuilt. It was used, and for a time, while they maintained that standard, things went well for them. Unfortunately, they began to backslide again, and we read about that in the book of Malachi and Ezra and Nehemiah. But you know, let's focus on the fact that at least for a while things were going well. And as I said, this is also prophetic. It projects all the way to seven times later in history, to the 24th day in the ninth month after 2,520 years, when the throne of David once again came into control of Jerusalem on December 9th, 1917. Now, if you have an interest in that, there's a very good history book on the subject, which I've talked about before, and it doesn't cover it from the perspective that I gave you. No. It's a secular historian, but she had a lot of insight. Her name was Barbara Tuchman, a Jewish lady who's been dead for a while, but who wrote some very important history books. She wrote one, I think, called Through a Glass Darkly, which is about the 14th century. She wrote that book, which is well known. She also wrote a book called Guns of August, about the First World War. You know, maybe some of those titles are familiar to you. As I said, her history books were bestsellers years ago. And she wrote a book called Bible and Sword, and about how the British got involved in the land of Palestine. And there were two factors involved. There was geopolitics, the sword, but there was also the Bible. The British were very biblical in the 19th century. That may be hard to believe now. You know, Britain is a very secular nation now, but the British were very biblical in the Victorian period. They knew their Bible and had a very big impact on them, and one reason why they got involved in the Middle East, and one reason why they supported the Jews' return to the land of Israel, the biblical influence on the British. Anyway, I'm in verse 20 of Haggai 2. And again the word of the Eternal came to Haggai in the 24th day of the month, saying, now we have the fourth word to Haggai, and this is a second time that on the 24th day of the ninth month a word is given. So we had the first one was on the new moon of Elul, the next one was on the 21st day of Tishrei, then we have on the 24th day of Kislev a first message and a second message. So here we have now the second message. Now some of you are I think still would like to hear more about Hanukkah, so come back on Hanukkah next Sabbath and you'll hear more about it, right? Anyway, let's go to Haggai 2, verse 20. And again, the word of the Eternal. By the way, one thing I didn't talk about regarding Hanukkah was the Sivivon or the dreidel, but I talked about that last week, so you don't have to hear about that again. Verse 20. And again, the word of the Eternal came to Haggai the 24th day of the month, saying, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake heaven and earth. I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms. I will destroy the strength of the Gentile kingdoms. Now, last week, I talked about a foreshadowing of that, how Alexander the Great swept into the Middle East and overthrew the Persians. At this point, they were under the control of the Persian Empire. About two centuries later, Alexander the Great was there, less than two centuries later, and there was a new rulership and a new age. Now, that was, however, as I said, just a foreshadowing. This projects into that time, but then even further. This is a millennial prophecy. This is looking forward to the second coming of Christ. I will shake heaven, and really, Zerubbabel and Joshua are both, as I said last week, types of Christ in certain ways. Joshua was the high priest, and his name is the same name as Jesus' name, and he was a type of Christ. And Zerubbabel, who was a descendant of David and was frankly an ancestor of Christ, was also a type of Christ. And those two combined together, civil rule and ecclesiastical rule, Christ combines both. Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake heaven and earth. I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms. I will destroy the strength of the Gentile kingdoms. I will overthrow the chariots and those who ride in them. The horses and their riders shall come down, everyone by the sword of his brother. So people will turn on each other, and will and therefore God, you know, God's people will win a great victory. And this, of course, is looking forward to the millennium and to the victory that Jesus Christ will win. Verse 23, in that day, says the Eternal of Hosts, I will take you, Zerubbabel, my servant. So here we're projecting forward Zerubbabel as a type of Christ. But it seems to me that if you should just read the verse for what it says, it's a promise to Zerubbabel. You'll be in the first resurrection. You'll be there. You know, so it seems to me that there are certain people, like Daniel, if you look at the book of Daniel, that were promised that they would be in that first resurrection, that they would be part of the ruling saints when Christ returns, and Zerubbabel evidently will be one of them. In that day, says the Eternal of Hosts, I will take you, Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, says the Eternal, will make you like a signet ring. You know, this is what you would use to make a, you put wax, and then you put your ring into the wax, and you make a symbol, and that's your signature, your John Hancock. That's your authorization. So Zerubbabel will be an authorization, will be an authority figure under Christ. I will take you, Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, says the Eternal, and will make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, says the Eternal of Hosts. So it's a beautiful conclusion. And it's talking about the kingdom of God. And what it's telling us is, in this book, seek you first the kingdom of God, and the rest will fall into place. And that's what we need to realize. And especially at this time of year, as I said, you get very busy, because this is an intense economic period for many people, where many people are working longer hours, or students are studying harder. I remember when I used to cram for exams, I used to pull the traditional all-nighter, you know, not quite, but close, you know, and I was pretty competitive as a student in those days, you know, and or you get busy, if you're in business yourself, this is a very busy time for you, you know, but don't let it, you know, just overwhelm you. And that's one reason why I remember, you know what happened to me yesterday? This very rarely has ever happened to me. I'm minding my own business. I'm shopping for the Sabbath. And a lady in the store says, you look tired. Well, yeah, I was tired. But what I didn't tell her was, well, the Sabbath is coming. So I'm okay. You know, I can hang in there, and then I've got the Sabbath coming. I didn't say that to her. You know, but that is one thing that at least we have an advantage, that eventually we do have to stop, you know, shut down for at least the Sabbath, you know. All right, let's go to 2 Corinthians 13 in conclusion. So each season of the year is a time to take stock of ourselves, each week and then each season. And during the autumn and the spring, we have commanded holidays. During the summer and the winter, the Jews have holidays, and I think Jews should take note of that. But everybody can take note of it because you read the Bible, and you can read the history in the Bible, and you can learn the lessons. So as I said before, know if you're a non-Jew, you don't necessarily have to keep Hanukkah. Now, I would recommend, you know, if you're married to a Jewish spouse, if you have close connections with the community and all that, I'm not saying you shouldn't keep it. I'm not saying don't. I'm just saying you don't have to. Don't worry about it. But, I mean, obviously, if you've got close ties to the Jewish community, have at it. The more, the merrier. 2 Corinthians 13. So as we get to this beginning of winter, as we get to the season of Hanukkah, or for everybody, the beginning of winter, remember what Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 13. He says, examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. So we have to periodically do this, week to week, and then season to season. Month to month is a good time to do it too, as you go from month to month. Examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? You see how much emphasis there is on each person, you know, taking stock. You know, so I don't have to butt into your life. You don't have to butt into mine. But we can, you know, butt into our own lives and say, you know, what's going on? You know, are you living up to the standard? Examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? Unless indeed you are disqualified. Unless we're reflecting the personality and character of Jesus Christ, we are disqualifying ourselves. So Paul continues and says, but I trust that you will know that we are not disqualified. That's the good news. So if we check, we're going to find out, no, we are not disqualified. That's great. So let's look forward to continuing on this path towards eternity. So I do appreciate those of you who are listening, and I do hope indeed that tomorrow, the 24th day of the ninth month, will be a day of blessing, and all the days ahead for that matter. I pray that I wish and pray and hope that the rest of the Sabbath will be a blessed day for you. And as I said, that you'll have a wonderful week ahead, and that you'll be joining us from perhaps weekly or at least from time to time. And in the meantime, all the best to you and your